Well, good morning, everyone. Great to have you guys with us. It's been another awesome and crazy week in the crazy life that I live, and I love it. So this week, as I was journeying through preparing for the story that we're going to be entering into today, wrestled with a question that I don't know that you've ever wrestled with or that you wrestle with all the time, but it was kind of try to look at humanity, the human race, us human beings, and try to sum up humanity in one word, like the human being, the human race. From the time we're born to the time we die, if you looked at a human being and you went, one word, here it is, this kind of sums up my experience of humanity, what would that word be? Anyone? Say it a little louder. Confused. I like that. Depraved. Yep. Lost. Rebellious. Selfish. Is anybody going to throw out like loving? Or good, kind, caring, selfless, unbelievable, wonderful. I mean, why is that? I'm just curious. I mean, it's not like it's just because we're the church, right? I mean, if you actually sit down and go, human beings, one word, the stuff that springs to mind are not the nicest words in the world, are they? I was thinking about it all week, so I've got a little bit of ahead of you guys, and so I've had more time. I started with all those words, kept boiling it down, and I ended up with a single word that I kind of like. Okay, here it is. Ready? My word summing up the human race. Mine. That's my word. Because I will say it's coming out of the experience of an adult that has a bunch of little kids, right? So you guys all know your children are born. First thing that comes out of the womb into the real world is a child that can't speak and can't move. And I think they lay in their crib and look around and go, it's all mine. All of it. And then the second they can move, they begin taking it all, right? Every time a small child entered my house, I warned my other children, run from sharp objects, they will be thrown at you regularly. Because a small child that can crawl, everything is theirs and they take it. They don't ask, right? And then they grow up and they learn because we tell them, you cannot just hit people and take what you want. So they turn from that violent act and they start arguing with each other. You guys have small children? It's like they fight about everything, right? Every 2 seconds, it's like, he took my this, she took my, yeah, well, that's because she had it first. They got a lollipop, I didn't get a lollipop. You're like, are you guys serious? They fight over the most incredible little things on the planet. But we're kind of kidding ourselves as adults because we do exactly the same thing. We just do it in a different version, right? We just recently traveled to Ethiopia to go and visit with our 4 children that are currently in Ethiopia that we hope to have here real soon, right? And I gotta say, coming back from Ethiopia, it was hard not to compare our craziness to what we met there because they're practically perfect children, right? I mean, you walk in, they're grateful for everything. They're thankful. They don't need to be entertained constantly. They don't fight with each other. They don't argue. They don't complain. They don't whine. I mean, I kind of went down the list. I'm like, wow. I mean, you kind of come back and go, where have we gone wrong? Right? But there is one thing that was like refreshing. I was like, at least they still do that. Right? Every time myself or Brooke was interacting with one of the children, one of the other kids in some way would do one of these. I call it the forward sidestep. Forward and side. And now they're in between you and the other child. It's subtle, but it's just saying, you're giving them attention. I love that story, but it's my turn. And they would just the forward sidestep. And I was watching this and thinking to myself, that's it. That's what you and I do every day of our lives, you and I. We have the forward sidestep. We are constantly and possibly daily trying to figure out ways to vie for position on this planet. You've been doing it since you were born. You're still doing it as an adult. You do it in your home and your marriage. We vie for position in our marriages. We don't call it that, and it doesn't feel that way, but it's that secret little thing that you sit in a chair quietly in your mind saying, how does she not get me? That's a vying for position. It's like, I got needs. I got stuff. That person's been with me for 15 years. What's the problem here? Right? We vie for position in our marriages. We vie for position as parents and children. We vie for position with our brothers and our sisters. We vie for position in our friendships, don't you? I mean, you don't walk into a friendship and go, oh, I just want to be a fly on the wall No, you want to get in, you want to get into the in crowd, then you want to get into the right people, then you want them to like you, and you want to feel special, and then you want to be part of things, and you want to be the most important friend they all have. We all feel that way. We vie for position at our workplace, or we vie for position when we're managing our homes. How many of you guys manage your home, and you look at all the other people managing homes, and their kids are better behaved, and their houses are more organized, and you wonder how it is you're not getting it right, and they are. And at work, we vie for position so that we can be advanced. Because, of course, we all know we are supposed to be pursuing the American dream to be happy and to be content and to be secure. And so we work our way to get more so that we can be safe and happy. And it's really a very subtle version of mine. 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 So we're following Jesus, right? He intersects our lives and we meet him, and then he begins to give us this vision of a kingdom that is eternal and powerful and beautiful, a kingdom free of sin and corruption and death and horror. And he begins to teach us about this kingdom and show us how that kingdom functions. And when he does, we start discovering pretty quickly that it seems that perhaps everything he teaches is in opposition to the way our kingdom functions. Maybe there's one or two things we can go, oh, it's kind of like us, but really not. Everything he lays out, we go, wow, that's not normal. And he goes, yeah, but the normal you know as normal is not necessarily good normal. And what we're going to walk into today is no exception to this incredible journey of Jesus reshaping us and giving us clarity and vision for what life could or should be like according to his kingdom. So the disciples have been traveling with Jesus for a while now. They've really integrated into his life and his purpose. He is their rabbi. They're becoming a little bit more like him. Some things have transpired over the last few months in the life of Jesus that are extraordinary, right? We walked through Luke chapter 8 and Luke chapter 9, where Jesus is preparing the disciples to go out into the world and to be salt and light to the earth, to carry the reality of the kingdom of God into the world and to live out that reality. So it's been an extraordinary run of Jesus teaching, demonstrating, and showing us the reality of the kingdom. And we kind of come to a point in the story in Luke chapter 9 that this really cool and crazy thing happens. So grab your Bibles and turn with me to Luke chapter 9. Under the chairs, there's a bunch of Bibles. If you don't have one of your own here, grab one of ours. And if you don't have a good Bible at home, take one of our Bibles, write your name in it, keep it for yourself. Love for you to have it. So Luke chapter 9, page 720 of our Bibles, or Luke chapter 9 in yours. Now, we've walked through in the recent weeks the transfiguration, the healing of the boy with evil spirits. We've seen Jesus declare himself Messiah in Peter's confession. We've experienced all these wonderful things, and what's beginning to transpire is that the disciples that are with Jesus are realizing that the guy they're with is very likely the promised Messiah from the days of old that is going to come and establish his throne and reign over Israel and keep Israel safe from all enemies and reign unendingly, right? And guess what the 12 guys are? They're the team he picked to reign with him. How awesome is that? It's kind of like you're in the garage when Apple is first on the scene and nobody's heard about it, and 40 years later, you're like, yeah, I got in on the early days. How would you feel? Or Starbucks. You're having coffee with old Howard there back 40 years ago when he starts the deal, and it's like, yeah, it's a little coffee shop in Seattle, and now you're here, and what does your portfolio look like? Oh, I'm a multi-billionaire. It's no big deal. I mean, there's certain things that if you get in on it early, it's awesome, right? We all know what they're like. Oh, I should have bought Microsoft way back when. That's kind of what the disciples are experiencing. They're realizing we're it. We're the little band of guys that got in on this story in a big way. And when Jesus becomes king of Israel, we get to rule with him. When you and I are in that position, we resort ourselves to holding on tightly to what we've been given, don't we? You don't want to lose that position, do you? So you like you do everything you can to go, I gotta vie for position here. I gotta stay on top of the game. So it's interesting, considering that they're traveling with Jesus, knowing who he is now, recognizing that he's potentially the Messiah, it's interesting that Jesus would tell them this particular thing at this particular time in verse 44 of Luke chapter 9. Read with me. So Jesus says this in verse 44, "Listen carefully to what I am about to tell you." Now listen, when the Messiah, the God of the universe, Jesus Christ, is speaking in general, the second a word comes out of his mouth, you ought to listen carefully. But when he actually bothers to say, "Listen carefully now," you ought to listen very, very carefully. Because what he's about to say is very, very important. And listen to what he says. "The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men." Now you and I, in hindsight, we know what Jesus is talking about, right? He's going to be betrayed, crucified, killed, and die at the hands of mankind, even though he is the Messiah, the chosen one, the King of all things. But the disciples, this doesn't even compute for them, right? Because he's going to set up his throne and reign forever, the King of the world, and they're going to reign with him. So the Bible actually bothers to tell us they did not understand what he meant. Okay, I buy that. "Guys, I'm going to be betrayed and turned over to mankind. I'm going to die." Okay. Don't know what that means. In fact, here's the disciples' response. "It was hidden from them, so they did not grasp it." Yeah. "And they were afraid to ask him about it." I love that. That's so human, isn't it? "Guys, I'm going to be betrayed and handed over to mankind and die." Wow. That's cool. What did he mean? I don't know. Don't ask. I bet those guys spent some time talking among themselves about what it might be like when he escapes from being betrayed. I wonder if they thought to themselves, "Boy, the guy that betrays him's in trouble." Right? But they certainly didn't think that he was actually going to die at the hands of mankind. That's not a possibility. Here's what I love about what happens next. Jesus, "Listen carefully. I'm going to die for your sake." And this is the response of the disciples, verse 46, the very next verse. "An argument started among the disciples as to which one of them would be the greatest." Isn't that lovely? "Guys, I am going to be betrayed and handed over to mankind to die." Wow. Walk over here. "I wonder who's going to be his right-hand man." I think it's going to be me. "No, it's not. You're nothing, man. I'm John. You're Peter. What are you talking?" And an argument breaks out about who's going to rule by his right hand. Isn't that crazy? Yesterday morning, I don't usually throw Hadley under the bus, but I asked her permission to do that, and she said sure, because she's practically perfect, but on occasion she gets some things wrong. So yesterday was one of those days, right? Hadley has a way, like me and others, to handle truth in such a way that she can shape it to gray the waters. Have you ever met someone like that? It's technically true what they're saying, but they're using it to gray the rest of the truth around it, right? So Hadley, on occasion, will find herself doing that. And yesterday was one of those days. Telling me the truth, but graying other truths. So, very serious stuff. When you are capable of lying, like all of us are, but you do it on a regular basis, you endanger your own life. Because if you can hide, then you can do whatever you want. And that's a very dangerous place to be. So I'm telling Hadley this. "Honey, this is very dangerous, and we don't do this. I'm bringing to bear all of my skills as a communicator to my daughter. I'm looking her in the eye. I'm being gentle. I'm thinking consciously through communication how to get this, because I want her to really get this. This is really, really, really important." So I'm done with my entire speech, and she's listened in, and I'm not quite sure how much of it she's gotten, but I'm hoping some got through. And she looks at me, and I'm done, and I look at her, and she goes, "Dad?" And I go, "Yes." And she goes, "Can I play your iPhone?" "Can I play your iPhone?" I mean, I actually looked at Hadley and I said to her, "Honey, here's a dad-to-daughter tip. When we have a discussion about life and death, the best response to that discussion is never, 'Dad, can I play your iPhone?' That is not a good response. That does not bring me the warm fuzzies at all, okay?" So that's exactly what's happening here. Thank goodness she's not alone on the planet doing that, because that's exactly what the disciples did. "I'm going to die for you." Wow, who's going to be the greatest? Who's going to reign with Jesus? Are you serious? Now, here's the cool part. Jesus, verse 47, knowing their thoughts. I love when the Bible says that. It's like the disciples declaring him to be God, right? They're just letting you know he didn't hear what they said. He wasn't in on the discussion. We never are on those discussions. But Jesus, knowing what they were thinking, he does something extraordinary. He says, Jesus, knowing their thoughts, took a little child and had him stand beside him. So now, the disciples are arguing off in the corner. They're done arguing. They're walking over. Jesus is sitting down, and there's a little child next to him. Let's talk about a little child for a second. How many of you guys love little children? Oh, yeah, we all love, we're Americans, we love little children, right? Great. But you know what? Here's the deal. As much as we love children, they are environments and they are circumstances in which they are burdensome, right? No, that would never be true. Let me share one with you. Yesterday, I was back in the hallway having a meeting with some people, right? Brooke was going to come pick the kids up at 4:30. I was having a meeting at 4:30. Brooke was running a little late, no big deal. So I start the meeting off. The kids are sitting in the hallway. Have you ever tried to have a productive meeting with four children in the hallway? Let me tell you what that moment is. In that particular circumstance, they feel burdensome, don't they? Because you sit down and go, so, how are you guys? Dad! Yes? Dad, I'm thirsty. I'm so sorry. Can you excuse me for a second? Shh. And does anybody else want water? Please share. Okay, great. I'm so sorry about that. So anyways, back to where we were. How are you guys doing? Dad, Hadley took the water. I'm sorry, so sorry. Share the water. I'm so sorry. So how are you guys doing? Dad, I was thinking, can we build Lego tonight? I'm so sorry. I might kill them. Have you ever sat in that moment? I mean, kids are crazy, right? Love them, but there's certain environments they don't belong in. And let me tell you one of the environments they don't belong in. Generally, when you're at work doing your thing, running hard, not a good place for kids. That's why the disciples, in general, saw kids as a very small value in the world they traveled. Every time the children arrived and Jesus was trying to heal people and teach wonderful and crazy and amazing things, and the children showed up, what did the disciples do? Would you please go play somewhere else, right? And we all like, oh, what horrible disciples. No, they're not. They're doing what's practical. Jesus is busy. He's at work. Please go somewhere else. Children have a very small value when you're running hard. They shouldn't, but they do. So in this case, Jesus sits in the midst of the hustle and bustle of going on in Luke chapter 8 and 9. He brings a child by his side, and the child's standing there. Can you imagine? Disciples walk up. Child, Jesus. And Jesus says these words. Whoever welcomes this little child in my name welcomes me. That's such a parental thing to say, isn't it? Don't you think? I mean, it sounds wonderful because we're all Christians and it's in the Bible, so we're like, oh, wise. But what does that really mean? I mean, if I were one of the disciples, I'd be like, all right, that's good. Welcome, child. I mean, what do you mean by that? If you welcome this child, you welcome me. It's wise, but it doesn't make any sense. So Jesus goes on. He says, and whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me. Now things start shaping because Jesus ties this to a much bigger equation. This was very typical of Jesus as a rabbi. He makes a small illustration. I am clearly more valuable than this child, right? I mean, who would you pick? A little kid that knows practically nothing or Jesus? Let's all be honest. Jesus. If you say the little child, then that's a problem, right? So who's more valuable, Jesus or the little child? Well, Jesus. And what Jesus says is, let me tell you something. When you value this child and welcome this child, you value me and you welcome me. Now watch what he does. And when you welcome me and you value me, you welcome God and you value God. I mean, you just took a jump from a kid to Jesus to God. Wow. So what is Jesus subtly doing? He's shifting a paradigm. He's saying, you don't value God, and then he tells you to value me, so you do it. When you value me, you value him. When you invite me, you invite him. And a child, when you invite the child, you invite me. So God's slowly starting to shape something backwards. He's making the child as valuable or more valuable than himself, and him more than God. It's kind of weird, but it's complicated, right? So if I wasn't here to tell you and I hadn't studied this and read, we might miss that. So Jesus, in typical style, makes it human simple for us. Here it is, right? As though he knows, we probably won't get the whole connection. He just says these words. For he who is least among you all is the one who is the greatest. And that's pretty simple. Any complications there? Tell you how it works in my kingdom. You who are least valued is actually you who are greatest in my world. He makes it so plain, so simple. In our world, we vie for position because greatness comes to him who is in front. In God's world, he says, the greatest among you are those who serve. The greatest among you are those who often in your world are valued least. So value them. Wow. It's a total paradigm shift. Now, just to illustrate to you how huge of a paradigm shift this is, because you think, wow, what lesson, little kid, Jesus, powerful disciples go, oh, we get it, Jesus. We're going to follow you now, and we're going to make everything greater than ourselves. You'd think that's what would happen in those moments, right? Because we've always said, if only I was with Jesus, then I could really live a mature Christian life. Watch this, okay? Page with me in the book of Luke to Luke chapter 22. I love this. Luke chapter 22, we've now gone months and months and months and months beyond that lesson. Jesus has been with the disciples 3 years now. He's been pouring his lifeblood into them. He's been demonstrating to them the power that he exists in. They know he's the Messiah. He's told them numerous times, I'm going to die for your sake. He's at the upper room at the Last Supper on the last night before he's going to go to the cross and be crucified, okay? This is a big moment. And the famous Last Supper occurs here in Luke chapter 22. Jesus is sitting at the table and we read that he takes the bread and he breaks it and he says, this is my body that breaks for you. And he pours the wine and says, this is my blood that will spill for you. I'm going to give myself as a living sacrifice for your sake. Huge stuff, right? Verse 20. He says, in the same way, after supper, he took the cup, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. So this is what's happening. This is the moment. Look at this. Verse 24. He's just done the cup of redemption. Also, a dispute arose among them as to which one of them would be considered the greatest. I mean, I almost want to take the Bible, go back and say, was that a misprint? Because there's no way at the Last Supper, in the midst of bread breaking and blood being poured out, that you guys would have the arrogance to sit at the table with Jesus, lean over and go, I wonder who's going to rule at his right hand. I think it's going to be me. You're vying for position while Jesus is about to die for you. Something is all wrong with that, isn't it? But you see, it speaks so much to our humanity, doesn't it? It's God whispering to us again, you think you can walk out of this door and just be unselfish? Good luck. Good luck. The disciples that were with me on the last night couldn't get it right. Now, if I were Jesus in that moment when they started arguing, I'll tell you what I would have done. I would have ascended straight up into heaven and said, you guys are on your own. You guys can be thankful every day that I'm not Jesus because it would have turned bad for humanity. Thank God he was, because his response was very different. In John chapter 13, we are told that Jesus, at the Last Supper, after the disciples are arguing, he takes off his outer cloak. He sets it aside. He wraps a towel around his waist. He takes a bowl, and he goes to the first disciple, and he sets the bowl down, and he gets on his knees, and he starts undoing the sandal of the first disciple. Now, there was a saying in Jewish tradition back in this day that said this: a disciple is responsible to his master for everything that a slave is to his rabbi for everything that a slave is responsible to his master for. So they're comparing a disciple to a slave, right? But they would say this, except for untying his sandals. That was actually part of the saying. You know why? Because there was nothing more degrading, nothing more lowly, nothing more devaluing than if you were the slave that was resorted to cleaning the feet of the people that came into the house. That was, if there were 10 slaves, this was the slave with the least value, okay? And Jesus gets down on his knees and he unties their sandals. No wonder the guys were like, not good. What are you doing? You can't untie my sandals. And Jesus washes their feet. And in John chapter 13, Jesus gets up. When he's done, he puts the stuff aside. He looks at the disciples and he says this: you call me master, and rightly so, for I am your master. but I have now shown you how you are to live according to my kingdom in the way that we function. The master serves the servant just as much as the servant serves the master. And he actually says it this way: in my kingdom, no servant is greater than his master, nor any messenger greater than the one who sent him. You guys function on a planet where you vie for position and then you feel good when people are lower than you. In my kingdom, we care for everyone equally. And now that I have done that, and he says it in John chapter 13, you have now seen me do this, now go and do it also, and if you do, you will be blessed, he says. Why? Why will you be blessed? I'll tell you, I was thinking about it. If I walk out of this place and I think to myself, okay, I go to work and I think to myself, what's in it for me? What's in it for me? Or I go to my home and I say, what's in it for me? It begins to shape in my mind a long list of entitlements that belong to me. That's how it works. Trust me, I'm like you. That's how it works. You go, you think what's in it for me, you begin to be entitled. Then, when anything is not met in your life, you begin to complain. Maybe not externally, but internally. You sit and you think to yourself, that place, that office I go to, they don't value me properly. They don't know what I bring to the table. They don't pay me enough. They don't treat me the way they should treat me. Have you ever been there? No, I bet none of you have ever felt that way. That's just me. Or we go home and we look at our spouse and we say those same words in our head. 15 years and they still don't get me. And they look at you and you look all down and they say, is anything the matter? And you go, no, nothing. And in your head you're spinning. If they have to ask the question, they don't get it. This week was a week like that for me. I was actually sitting there going, man, I just, you know, and I, at one moment I even sat and I thought, maybe I'm a girl because I'm having all these girl thoughts about how my needs aren't being met and my spouse isn't, and if they don't understand me and can't read my mind and it doesn't work, and I'm like, this is generally the other way around. But that's exactly what was happening to me, because you know, we all do it, don't we? And Jesus says, if you walk out into a world where you are entitled, where you have measured for yourself what you deserve, what's in it for you, then you are going to find yourself in a life that lacks a great deal of joy and is filled with a great deal of complaining and whining. And you know what complaining and whining does? When others do it to you, what does it do? It drains the life out of you, doesn't it? My kids complain and whine all the time, and I'm like, breathe, because it takes the life out of you. But when you complain to yourself or you complain to others, it digs deep into your soul and it robs you of joy. The joy of the Lord goes away, and coming into your life is the darkness of whining and complaining, and it is born out of entitlement. Jesus says to you and to me, in my kingdom, you choose to give yourself away for the sake of the least of these. You choose not to be entitled. You choose to be less than you deserve, because when you do, you will find life and freedom and joy that you cannot imagine. See, Jesus demonstrates the day after the incident with the washing of the feet the ultimate beauty of how this functions. Jesus went to the cross. Let me ask you guys, was Jesus a victim of humanity's horror as we nailed him to the cross? No. If you think he was, you don't know Jesus very well. The Bible actually tells us that at any given moment he could have said a word and all of the angels in heaven would have wiped us off the planet. Yeah, pretty violent. Jesus was not a victim of the cross. He was a voluntary, intentional sacrifice for us. The most powerful thing you and I can be is a voluntary, intentional servant for the sake of the kingdom. God's not asking you to be a doormat. He's not asking you to be a victim. He's not asking you to take the abuses of this planet and just lay there. He's asking you to choose to become less so that others can become more. That's what he's asking you to do. See, the paradigm shift is actually quite simple. We wake up every morning and subtly we ask ourselves in every arena and relationship in our lives, what's in it for me? And Jesus comes along and says, you want to be free? Listen carefully. Ask yourself this question. What's in it for Jesus? What's in it for him? Not what's in it for me, what's in it for him? See, if you wake up as a husband and go, what's in it for him that I'm a husband? That will shape the way you do husbandry. As a wife, that will shape it. When you go to work, if you say, Jesus, today, what's in it for you when I go to the office? It will shape the way you handle your day at work. If you look at the resources you've been given, if they're abundance and they're more than you know what to do with, and you say, Jesus, what's in it for you that I have so much? You will handle it one way. And if you have nothing, if you have no resources and it seems like you live in poverty, you will ask Jesus what's in it for you, and it will shape the way you handle poverty. See, when we ask what's in it for Jesus, it changes everything. And this story is Jesus simply saying to us, in my kingdom, everyone asks the same question. What's in it for the guy on the throne? My life is his, and I will live it for him. Paul writes it this way in Galatians chapter 2. I have been crucified with Christ. I no longer live, but Christ lives in me, and my life is his. I am a husband for Christ's sake. I am a worker for Christ's sake. I am a father for Christ's sake. I come to church for Christ's sake. And my opportunity to serve the 6.2 billion other people on this planet is an opportunity to bring into reality the mercy and grace and wonder of the love of God. And whatever I do, I live for him. You want to be free? Then you learn to get there. And the only way you and I are ever going to accomplish that is by becoming more and more receptive to the Spirit of God that resides in us and allowing him to lead us into the fruit that is ours to bear. I was thinking this week, how do I even send you out of here with an application on this one, right? Here it is. Ready? Go. Change your entire paradigm. No longer think about yourself. Give yourself away for the sake of others. Don't vie for position. Think about Jesus only. I mean, if we could get that right this week, you do not have to come back next Sunday. Okay? Don't bother. Just stay out there. You're fine, right? Because if the disciples couldn't get it till the Last Supper, I don't think we're going to get it by me sending you out here today that way. But this is an important enough issue that you and I ought to be wrestling with this daily, right? So I'm going to ask you guys a favor this week. I'm going to give you something this week to do by yourselves that's outside of what happens on Sunday so that you could re-wrestle with this as we approach the week. We had an opportunity this week. A family that's in our church has a young son. Their name is the Hargers. They're going to be right up here. They're the Hargers. Jordan's actually one of our deacons, and that's their beautiful family. And here on the one side is a little boy named Cy. Cy has a little disease, okay? Here's what his disease does to him. He is allergic to all foods, all of them. I'm not talking about some or stuff with this in or read a label. If it's chewable, he's allergic to it, okay? Can't eat. But he's alive. Yes, he is. Why? Because he's on a liquid diet. It's these special little yucky juices. I've tasted them. And he drinks them. That's his breakfast, his lunch, and his dinner. It's the same juice. It just, he drinks juice, and it gives his body all the things that it needs. But he actually has to chew things just to teach his brain and remind his brain on how to chew, because he chews so little, his brain forgets the chewing response, right? Crazy, huh? So they introduce one food at a time into Cy's life, like squashed up sweet potatoes was one for a while. And then, you know, these little foods, and they give it to him for a little while, and then they take him in for tests, and they're like, yep, he's allergic to that one too. Ding, mark that off the list. So it's a very discouraging process, because the doctors are like, I can tell you right now, this food right here, very likely not to be allergic to this. Eat it, allergic. So they just went back for tests about a week ago after introducing some foods, and guess what? The news, he's allergic to all of them. Oh well, back to the juices. And so now for a few months, he's back to just drinking juice until they can introduce one more food to him to see. And when he's like 25 or 30, maybe we'll find a food that he can actually chew. Pretty crazy, right? So here's the opportunity we have. Jesus took a little child and stood the little child next to him and said to his disciples, if you value this child, if you welcome this child, if you think that this child is important, then you welcome me and you value me. The ones that are least in our world are greatest in mine. So may I borrow Sai for your sake and stand Sai next to me and say, this week, here's what I want you to do. On Wednesday of this week, one day, I want you to wake up in the morning and I want you to fast with me. Juice, that's it. Water, that's it. Just liquid, okay? And when you put coffee in water, that does not count as a flavorant, okay? This is water and juice, that's it. Yeah, your coffee drinkers are all like, oh, is that like 13 hours or 24? I'm not sure. No eating, no chewing gum, no none of that. You drink water or you drink juice. If you blend stuff in a blender, that's still food. It doesn't count, okay? It's got to be liquid, water, juice. And all day long, I just want you to drink water, and I just want you to drink juice as your meals and as what you do. And every moment that you look at that little juice box and you drink it and you go, wow, I could use some Five Guys right now. I want you to sit down, and I want you to pray two things, just two things. The first prayer is this, throughout the day regularly, God, I pray for Sai, that you would heal him of this. And if you should choose not to heal him physically of this, then by all means, change the world through his story. That's my prayer for Sai. Because I think Sai, when he's an adult, if he's going to be part of this church and he's going to live missionally, he would ask for one of two things, either heal me or change the world through me. And I'm going to ask the same thing. And then while you're praying for Sai, if there's anyone you know in your story that's struggling, that's got a sick child or a sick wife or husband or struggling financially to the point of desperation, by all means, add them into your prayer list and just say, God, I also pray for them. So what's the first thing you're going to pray for? Sai and his family and a friend or friends that you have. And then the second prayer, here's the one, don't pray this unless you dare. I want you to sit down and I want you to say, God, I know that I am entitled to certain things. Show me where in my life they reign the most and give me the wisdom and the strength to eliminate them out of my life. Do I feel entitled in my marriage? Then help me to be a husband that loves unconditionally. Do I feel entitled in my workplace and I complain constantly about how they treat me? Then help me to learn to serve them. Do I feel entitled in my friendships? Where is it that I feel I deserve? And allow me to let that go. And teach me these words, Jesus. What is in it for you? You pray that on Wednesday, and I promise you the Spirit of God will show you some things. And when he does, you make a short list. Oop, yeah, that's definitely an area I complain a lot, and I think I deserve a lot. And when you've made your little list, it needs to be short. Don't be overwhelmed. There's going to be a lot on the list. Pick one, okay? At least if you're me. It's like, oh, okay, pick this one. Then email that or Facebook that or text that to a friend that you trust that loves Jesus and say, here's where I struggle right now. I would ask you to pray with me on this. And on a regular basis, just say, hey, how's it going allowing the Spirit of God to reign in that area of your life? May we as a church wrestle together through what it means to value a kingdom that says the least of these are the greatest and change our paradigm from what is in it for me to what is in it for you, Jesus. Let's pray. God, I know as I stand on the stage, there's a million questions that have run through my mind this week that I know are running through the minds of many here in this room. What does this mean? What does this mean about advancement or promotion? What does this mean about trying to do well at work or do well in my home? What does this mean in terms of my needs and what I need and what I need to grow? God, these are complicated and difficult questions, and for each of us, they are questions we are going to need you, Spirit of God, to speak to us about and answer for us. Because they are not easy to answer. God, I know you're not calling us to be victims or doormats. You're not calling us to never advance or never desire to do better at things. But God, you are calling us to give ourselves away to lay our dreams down and to give them to you and to say, you use me for the expansion of your kingdom and the glory of your name. And God, that is a hard, hard lesson for any one of us in this room to grasp. So we beg of you, Spirit of God, rise up in us and teach us how to spend ourselves for your sake. Give us the wisdom we need on Wednesday as we seek and pray and fast together on what we need to let go of and what we need to hand back to you so that we would be servants of the Lord Jesus in all the relationships and circumstances that we find ourselves. We do love you, Jesus. Continue to complete the work that you've begun in us, for we desperately need you to do it.